kooky, mysterious and spooky. They're all together ooky, the Addams Family. The house is a museum, when people come to see them, they really are a scream, the Addams Family.
Neat. Sweet. Petite.
So get a witch's shawl on, a broomstick you can crawl on. We're gonna pay a call on the Addams Family.
You're listening to WMFO in Medford. That's WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. You're about to hear a slice of that community-based socialist alternative radio. And it will be here for the next 2 hours, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. every other Sunday. And socialist alternative radio is talk and music from a working-class democratic socialist perspective. And today's show, we're going to be talking about socialists running for political office in the United States. It is happening. It does happen. There is a current socialist city councilor of a major city, Seattle, Shama Sawant, who we mentioned many times on the show. She's a member of Socialist Alternative and is in her second term. She was reelected recently with a wider majority than she got elected on. Wider number of votes, more votes. Having trouble speaking today. We also will be talking about the struggle for independence in Catalan, in Spain. We'll be talking about, as well, a couple books that have come out recently that would be very interesting to anyone wanting to find out more about socialism here in the United States and elsewhere. And we're going to just throw on some music here really quick because I have to take care of something here, technical in the studio. So again, we'll be back in a second. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio on WMFO, 91.5 FM here in Medford. And we go worldwide on WMFO.org via the internet, the World Wide Web, so whatever you want to call it. So we'll be right back.
Age of Reason! killers. The dreams flow into savage toy.
Hear the siren screaming out across the city. We had three odd nights in succession. The riot season is here again.
Dear Lord, lead us back to the valley of the shadow.
Born in peaceful times. The world in derby spinning around. Faster, faster. The center cannot hold. Like a world in derby spinning, spinning faster. Ah, oh, the center cannot hold. On the age of reason.
New Model Army with Here Comes the War from New Model Army's album called New Model Army Original 20. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio here at WMFO 91.5 FM, Medford, Tufts, Greater Boston. We'll add Freeform Radio, commercial free, community based, and all that good stuff. And we are part of that community-based socialist alternative radio here every other Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Put down your brunch forks and knives and whatever else you're doing to distract yourself and listen. You know, we're here to not just give you alternative news and information, although we do that. We are also here for to go a little deeper than that, to get you interested, if possible, in changing the world. And that sounds ambitious, but we're doing it. We're organizing for socialism internationally, and we are part of a movement that is currently not that in evidence, but it is breaking out here or there where it can be seen. And we hope that you will join us in really what amounts to the best hope for human survival. I mean, if you think capitalism can sustain the human habitat, the environment for human habitation for any length of time, any reasonable length of time, scientific evidence says that's not happening. If you think that capitalism can avoid wars that will turn even more catastrophic than the ones that are currently happening, some sort of nuclear war or some sort of war that, you know, exacerbates already, you know, horrible social problems and inequality and so on, that would grow, that would, you know, go beyond the sort of controlled proxy wars that the U.S. has been involved in for the most part recently. If you think capitalism can handle all this stuff, you know, just on the way here, I was just listening to how many, I forget the figure, I think it was millions, they estimate have died from pollution just in the past year, pollution-related deaths, if you want to put it nicely. And so basically you have a situation where if you look closely at what's happening with capitalism, the economic system that then controls the political system here in the United States and elsewhere around the world, basically every country in the world, even countries that we're told are something else, like North Korea, we're told is communist. Actually, they gave up on Stalinism, their form of communism. They gave up on that a while ago and have a sort of nationalistic sort of thing going, dictatorship going on, which is not unusual under capitalism, however strange they try to make that dictatorship seem. In, you know, whether they have a full-blown capitalist economy, more of state capitalism is another question, but they aren't, They aren't what we're told they are, and they are dominated no matter what they choose to be. They are, what the government, the dictatorship chooses itself to, how to market itself or whatever. They are dominated by world capitalism. You can't have capitalism in one country, contrary to some versions of socialism or communism, like Stalinism tried to put forward. It's impossible. The world market will dominate. Socialism has to be international. It has to be in many different countries at once. And that's why attempts to form socialism in Cuba, places like Cuba or Venezuela, as long as they're kept isolated, as long as the revolution doesn't spread, and more so for the Russian Revolution, which was on a much wider, more powerful and healthier basis when it first happened 100 years ago in 1917. As long as those revolutions are kept somewhat isolated, I don't know why I put the qualifier on there, then you can't really create socialism. And there's, this idea we've talked about on the show before that, people will just sort of knee-jerk reaction because they're basically brainwashed this way, say, well, socialism didn't work. It's, the implication or the explicit statement being that it was some sort of experiment, that failed. Well, I never heard of an experiment that was so messed with. It would be like setting up an experiment and having, and driving a truck through it, in a nice little lab somewhere. The equivalent happened with the invasion of, 19 capitalist armies invading Russia right after its revolution, or soon after its revolution, setting up even before that, an economic embargo to isolate the country that already had a weak economy due to World War I, which was a great, capitalist adventure, bloody struggle over control of colonies. And in Russia, the what was left of the Tsarist regime and then the reformist liberal regime pursuing World War I, even though Russia didn't have any colonies to speak of, it just bleeded the country, killed, thousands, tens of thousands of people for no reason. A big reason the revolution happened, to stop the carnage and the stupidity of the war, World War I. That weakening the economy, then the economic embargo placed on by imperialist powers, by capitalist powers after the war, World War I, made things even more difficult, not to mention all the propaganda, etc. So it's not as if socialism has ever been an experiment left alone to flourish somewhere. Other experiments, if you want to use that term for one second, however fallacious, you could say, well, Spain in the 30s experimented, quote-unquote, with socialism. And had a lot of anarchists involved in that struggle, and yet that was right from the beginning a defensive struggle, where a fascist government, a fascist army was created after an election was lost to left wingers and liberals, and a fascist army under Franco just invaded the country, and then there was a prolonged civil war, and eventually the fascists won with help from fascist Germany and fascist Italy and so on, and the United States and Britain and others, let that happen because they had no interest in seeing a socialist or some other radical type government emerge for any time. I mean, there were parts of Spain that were liberated for a while, and that's relevant to what we're going to be talking about later with Catalan and Catalonia and the struggle there for independence, which is getting very little media attention in the United States. Just when something flares up, when there's a huge something or other rally or huge bit of a repression, you might hear something in the corporate media, but it's pretty rare here in the United States to hear about it. And then, you had even going back to the 1870s, 1871, the Paris, or 1870 or 71, the Paris Commune, I think it was 70, where the workers of Paris, also sick of another bloody war, Paris and around Paris, sick of a bloody war that was happening, revolted, started to set up a sort of a socialist government, and that only lasted for 6 weeks because all of a sudden the French army, the generals, the rulers of the French army, the government, the generals, and the Prussian or Russian or German army all made nice, because they had a common interest in maintaining their ruling class, rule, the rule of the bourgeois, and they combined to invade or let the French, the Germans all of a sudden provided cover for the French, instead of fighting them, for the French army to invade Paris in 1870. It was called the Paris Commune, and massacred men, women, and children who were fighting for a different system other than capitalism. So all these so-called experiments for socialism, and there's others as well, they're not left alone to develop. They try to develop in the death throes of capitalism, really, if you look at it from a wide historical angle. And basically capitalist powers will fight to maintain their privilege and wealth and so on, and everything that goes along with that. By any means necessary, they'll use any means they can to divide working people, including racism and sexism and so on, and all sorts of repression and nationalism, of course. And they'll just, sacrifice humanity ultimately for the short-term maximization of profit. And that a lot of people want to stop that. Not everyone sees a way forward or an alternative, but alternatives do exist. An alternative exists. A way forward does exist. Many ways forward, actually, for working people to really just realize their own power. If you're able to organize on a wide enough scale, and that's a trick, of course, but it has been done, and it can be done. If you're able to organize on a wide enough scale for people that actually produce things and distribute things, working people, to organize against the very, very tiny amount of people that rule over them and their labor, then you can stop the running of society and go proceed to create a new society. Now, of course, that is more complicated than making it sound, but that's the root of it. And the harder part comes when the inevitable counter-revolution comes to stop that from happening, or to, like I said, mess with the experiment, so-called experiment, or experiments of socialism that crop up in very, micro terms, everything from, regions and even places that, states or whatever that pass things that sound socialist to full-blown socialist revolutions that have happened. Capitalism will try to strangle those to death. I've lived through some of that personally. I was in France, for example, in 1983, which was quickly dismantling an attempt at constructing socialism. That because a communist socialist government had been elected, and they took some steps like nationalizing the banking system and so on to actually fulfill the mandate of the people in the election. This was in 1980-81. And by the time I got there in 83, they were dismantling it all under threat of capital, basically, under the big businesses saying, we're not going to invest, we're going to take our money elsewhere, we're going to strangle you. And instead of organizing a mass movement to stop that, the leader of the Socialist Party, Mitterrand, and others conspired to give in, conspired to say, oh, well, nothing we can do about that. Come back and we'll just sort of have some regulations and some reforms here and do what you want. The French people, like others, have been suffering ever since in growing inequality, unemployment, growing racism and so on, racist movements. Far-right movements and racist movements don't exist in a vacuum. They don't, although they're kept simmering by the inequalities of capitalism and by the capitalists themselves wanting actually fascist elements they can rely on from time to time when they can't rule any other way. The reality is that most people, vast majority of people, have nothing to do with the far right and don't want anything to do with it. And the only time that masses of people will consider voting for, like it has happened in some European countries recently, far-right parties, is when the left has grown so weak and has capitulated so clearly to capitalism that they've seen that people, a certain number of people, see no alternative on the left, and they mistakenly and tragically then look for it elsewhere. And look for explanations for why things are the way they are in some really twisted, idiotic ways, mythologies out there about race and so on, about immigrants and everything else. Here on Socialist Alternative Radio and Socialist Alternative in general, and in the Committee for Workers International, which Socialist Alternative is in political solidarity with, you know, we've studied revolutions, we've been involved in mass movements, we've initiated mass movements, we've worked hard to show clearly an alternative, to be open with our politics as socialists, proud democratic socialists that have a way forward other than the chaos and destruction of capitalism that is there around us. Here in the United States, if you're listening internationally, we do have some international listeners, there is a economic upswing, supposedly, for the certain, there are certain economic indicators that show that, others that don't, but there's relatively low unemployment, although people still feel, I think, that it's, from my anecdotal evidence of working in a big workplace and seeing people come and go, I think people still feel a lot of pressure. Like, it's not really that easy to get a job, and certainly not easy to get a job that pays a living wage or allows you to live comfortably, even if it's paying a so-called living wage. There's still a sort of precarious feeling, and that word's been thrown around a lot, the precarious nature of work now in the United States, where the bosses are making it seem like, yeah, you can be replaced tomorrow by a robot, or you can be replaced tomorrow by outsourcing, or you can be replaced tomorrow by whatever. And it's not usually true, but they're using it as a club. And other things too, like health insurance costs. There's millions of Americans that get their health insurance through the not the government, not Medicare, Medicaid, like people in other countries may have a hard time understanding this, but in the United States, a lot of people are without health insurance totally, without access to health care, unless they go to an emergency room, and then they get charged a lot of money, and they never can pay it back, and they're in debt. Or even people with insurance, the insurance won't cover what they need, they get charged a lot of money, they're in perpetual debt, they go bankrupt, whatever. But there's also people that have health insurance, but they have it through corporations that are spending all their time now trying to cut the amount they pay into the health insurance, increase the amount we pay in as workers, and lower the quality of the health insurance, constrict the range of choices, and make it the cheapest, rottenest healthcare that they can get away with, depending on if there's a union or a union that will fight or won't fight or whatever. Now, where I work at Harvard University, I'm in a section of the workforce that is unionized, but the union leadership is much more concerned with being partners, quote unquote, with management than with fighting for the workers that helped organize the union and brought the union in. This is not an unusual story, unfortunately, with the labor movement in the United States right now. And the result is that the Harvard Corporation, which has no need to do this, but just has always tried to make more money, they're running a so-called nonprofit as a money-grubbing, short-term maximization of profit institution, and they are going after our healthcare benefits and have been for years. You could make the argument that having a union has slowed that process down, and I would agree with that, but it hasn't stopped the process, reversed the process. I mean, and when we came in, we had the opportunity as a union to actually get free healthcare for everyone, and we didn't even try for that. Not that many union members wanted us to try for it, but the union leadership set up a situation of no democracy in the union, and therefore no need to try to listen to the pressure from the members to increase health benefits. So basically, health benefits came in as they were prior to the union in terms of how much Harvard paid and how much we had to pay, and it's gotten worse ever since in increments, and now it's accelerating the attacks that Harvard is making, like many other corporations, on healthcare in the United, healthcare for literally tens of millions of workers in the United States that get it, unfortunately, through their corporation rather than through a socialized medicine national health service, like in Britain, for example, or other countries. So there's a lot of things happening in the United States that point to, despite the economic, you know, the relative upturn in the economy, that point to rough times for workers and times for that don't feel like there's any future for our children, those of us that have children, or those of us that care about other people's children, how to afford college now is pretty much a mystery for millions, tens of millions of people. How to afford a decent school. It's sort of like the lottery now in the United States. If you're lucky, you might get some scholarship money. You might cobble together some loans, but the problem is you'll be paying for those loans for the rest of your life, probably. And that limits your ability to do anything from buy a house to rent a nice apartment, if you can find one, to having children, getting married. I mean, it just affects everything you do if you're carrying that kind of debt. We're talking about a huge debt load from the cost of college now. And the United States could easily afford completely reorganize the way kindergarten through 12th grade, or preschool through 12th grade schools are funded now, primarily through property taxes. That could be eliminated or drastically reduced, and you could have direct subsidy from the government, just cut the military spending, raise taxes on the rich, do the opposite of what Trump is doing, you know, raise taxes on the rich and the super rich, and the big corporations. You'd have more than enough money to not only have free education, including free college education, but free healthcare as well. And capitalism, that could actually be accomplished under capitalism. It would be a big struggle, but it could be accomplished. Now, whether it could be sustained is another thing. One reason I'm a socialist and other people are socialists, meaning revolutionary socialists that really want to see democratic socialist society and economy, is that any reforms won under capitalism are unfortunately temporary because of the nature of the capitalist system. The capitalists are always trying to increase their short-term maximization of profit, and anything that cuts into profit from their point of view, like taxes or whatever, they want to lower. And they want to always go after. So even in a country like Britain that has a national health service that the left fought for and won through the Labour Party there, that is being chipped away at and has been for a long time. Funding cut, a parallel private system being created, enforce scarcity where there doesn't have to be any to get people pissed off. I mean, this formula for privatization is pretty simple, and they're doing it right here in Boston, in the Boston area, with the MBTA, the subway and bus service that covers a greater Boston. There, and by greater Boston, I mean outlying cities and communities, not just Boston itself. And this adds up once you leave Boston. Start talking about greater Boston, you're talking about, you know, I think it's 4.5 million people or something like that. 5 million people, I forget the exact number. This is the attempt to privatize the subway and bus system for this entire region, including the commuter rail, which they've already kind of outsourced. They have outsourced it. There's tons of problems with it, but no, they never say it's because of outsourcing, right? Whenever there's a city-owned or municipally-owned thing or state-owned thing, the problem is because it's state-owned or municipally-owned, and they will go on about that in the corporate media for hours and hours. But if it's an outsourced entity, like Keolis in this area, for these commuter rails that's been having problem after problem after problem, delay, if you hear about that, they'll mention the company Keolis, but they'll mention it as if it was just like a natural thing that Keolis is running this commuter rail, instead of saying outsourcing has created a mess of the commuter rail or what's left of it in the greater Boston area. And now it's ironic because just to riff for a second on that, there's this big corporation here in the U.S., Amazon, which started off delivering books and so on, and now they've got their hooks into all sorts of delivery of all sorts of products. I'm not sure if they're into any basic manufacturing yet. I wouldn't be surprised if they were. I haven't really studied it that closely, but they're growing and they're looking for a second headquarters to set up somewhere. And so all these cities are groveling before them. All these city governments run by Democrats, doesn't matter, run by Republicans. They're all well, there aren't that many city governments run by Republicans, but anyway, they're groveling before the great god of Amazon to show some favor, to come and set up a company where the corporate media accepts as fact Amazon's contention that the average job will pay $100,000 a year. Now, this is statistically not possible, most likely. And just you know, an obvious thing to check on, like do the math, check on those numbers. Corporate media, they won't do it. They just take it as fact. So the cities are offering tax breaks and who knows what else. Some cities like Providence, Rhode Island, they won't even release what they want to do, what they've offered Amazon. And this is the Democrats mostly, Democratic Party mostly doing this. And it's just such a joke, you know, because... And some of the corporate media has gotten into this a little bit. If Amazon showed up to a place like Boston, and if it really did try to, hire 50,000 workers, which is another spurious claim, but one taken as fact, then they would run into infrastructure problems like you wouldn't believe from everything. They've been closing down schools in Boston for years. They don't talk about it. The current mayor is running for election, and I don't hear anybody, maybe one of his opponents is, but I haven't really heard this directly, saying, hey, what about these round of school closings that happened? Some of them happened before Walsh came in. That's the mayor of Boston, Walsh, but he's never spoken out against the previous ones, and that's the general decline in the schools in Boston. Everything from the schools to what I mentioned about the subway and train system, the constant push to privatize aspects of that, which makes it worse, which makes it more inefficient. Privatization makes it much more inefficient than directly run. And then moving on to things like just basic traffic coming in and out of the city, which I have a commute. I can attest to the fact that the traffic situation is busting wide open. It's just intolerable. Something's going to break. And there's already so many accidents, you wouldn't believe it, and it's because of that. There's just no basic engineering happening to relieve that pressure that Boston gets from north, south, east, and west every morning. And it takes a real toll on working people. Like everyone's got their little personal survival strategies they'll swear by, rather than look at the systemic problems that exist under capitalism or look at the system as a whole. And they'll say things like, well, I do this or that, you know, it's really not a problem. And then when you get to know them a little bit, you see it's a huge problem, actually. Your survival strategy is costing you all your spare time, practically, and all your spare money, and you're living miserably, you know. I just found out something really tragic at work along those lines. A very, very serious aspect of what I'm talking about is that somebody that actually died in my workplace, I thought died, you know, possibly due to work-related stress. The person was given too much work to do and so on. And it was hard work, physical work. And I found out recently, like a year or more after this death, I found out that the person was working two jobs because their brother was in debt and they were trying to help work off that debt. This is a common thing to people to try all sorts of things. If they can find another job, then that's not necessarily what people do, but they'll do all sorts of things like I'm doing to try to alleviate debt loads or try to just survive. So getting back to the traffic example, it's like it was sort of common knowledge. Well, if you got up early enough, you could make your way into Boston and beat the rush hour, right? Well, the problem is, and this happens all over the country in cities, small and large, people are, you know, getting up at ridiculously early times because really their lives revolve around their job, not the other way around. They're living to work, not working to live. That should be the motto in the United States. The American dream becomes such a wage slave that you're basically living to work. You're basically living to make profits for some rich jerk that's already got more money than you know what to do with. And so that includes, wonderful survival strategies like I'm getting up early and beating the traffic. So, you know, I'm getting up at 4:30 in the morning and I'm jumping in my car by 5 and I'm really beating the traffic. Well, the problem is that rush hour keeps creeping backwards, you know. I was on the Mass Pike at 6:10 a.m. in a traffic jam the other day, right? So what time do you have to get up? And I have a 20-minute drive to the Mass Pike, right? So this is going west to east. And what time do you have to get up then to beat the traffic? Do you have to get up at 3 a.m. now or whatever? Or are there some, and there are some places, like I've been to New York, where I felt like no matter what time you tried to get into the city, there would be certain places at least where there would be bottlenecks and backups no matter what time it was. I remember being in California one time. between L.A. And San Francisco, or L.A. and San Juan Capistrano, actually, and the in the middle of nowhere, like at 1 p.m., you know, on a weekday, in a terrible gridlock, went for miles and miles. I'm like, and there was no accident. There was no, like, reason for it other than volume of traffic, you know? So this is happening all over the place, including around Boston. Bring in Amazon. So some guy gets on the radio, national propaganda radio, and starts talking about all the things they would need to do to cater to Amazon. Of course, these are things that a lot of them, their people have been organizing for and fighting for years, like improvements to the train system to hook up two passenger lines that can't meet in Boston, but you know, having building a tunnel where they could meet within Boston and go through the city quickly. There's expanding the subway system, which they're loath to do. They keep delaying a court-mandated expansion of the subway system in the Boston area here, right near this radio station, actually, in Somerville. They keep delaying that. They don't want to put shovels in the ground. They made one subway station recently at a place where they plopped a lot of stores, and it was obviously the stores were the big, you know, box stores were, and restaurants and stuff were like, this is going to be a new gold mine for us. You better plop down the money for a subway stop there in the cities. The MBTA dutifully obeyed, reluctantly, but dutifully obeyed, and set up and created a cheapo subway stop there. Anyway, so what we're getting at basically is that you have a situation here where in the United States, where the economy on the surface, in terms of the stock market, in terms of unemployment rates, we're being fed a daily dose of, hey, things are great. Stock market's breaking another record, and unemployment is, they call it full employment, which is a complete lie. When you study the statistics, there's a lot of people that have given up looking for work, and there's still a lot of people unemployed. But relatively speaking, it's less than it was in previous years, especially the memory of the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, 2007, 2008, and so on. But people aren't feeling that. They're feeling like, where's the future? How are we gonna survive the high rents, the high cost of housing, the incredibly ridiculous cost of higher education? What's this gonna be like? Even if I'm surviving for this moment, what's this gonna be like? How can I sustain this debt any longer? That's what's going through people's heads. Can I get another job? Can I save here, save there? You know. And meanwhile, you know, if you have children, your children suffer. Their choices of what they can engage with, what they can do, goes down. You see upper middle class people or rich people, you know, getting the tutoring, getting the after school or weekend curriculum things, getting the vacations that your kids just aren't getting, you know, anymore or never had to begin with. So what's to be done about that? Well, there are people that are voting their conscience where they can. They're voting for a change, fundamental change. They're voting for, they're not going to take it anymore. And these aren't the deluded Trump voters I'm talking about, or the deluded Clinton voters, actually. I'm talking about people that are broken with the two-party system, and they're considering voting socialist. And like I mentioned earlier, there is a member of Socialist Alternative, Shama Sawant. The way you spell Shama's name is K-S-H-A-M-A, and her last name is S-A-W-A-N-T, S-A-W-A-N-T, Sawant, if you want to look her up. Shama Sawant, a member of Socialist Alternative, got elected first in, I think it was 2013, her campaign and Socialist Alternative and other supporters turned the main and most popular demand from that campaign for $15 minimum wage into a campaign that extended beyond the election in 2013 and won a $15 minimum wage law in Seattle, Washington, in the U.S. Soon after that, I think it was in late 2014 into 2015. And then due to a strange thing in the Seattle redistricting law or whatever, Shama had everyone had to run again for office, and she ran again. I think it was in 2016, and was reelected with a larger amount of the vote than the first time around. And actually helped went out there and helped with that campaign a little bit in 2016, and it was a great experience. And so there are places in the United States where there are left independents running, progressive greens, left greens, left independence, you know, and I think I already said that. Anyway, you get the picture. People that, even sometimes people run under the Socialist Party, which is a very small group, but they've got the ballot line in some states. And there are sometimes people to vote for. Not always, in many cases not. What I do in that situation is I write in somebody, left, historical figure or contemporary. But in any case, there is more, more interest in socialism in general in the United States. There's more, polling data shows that quite clearly. In fact, majorities among favorable attitude towards the word socialism among people of color and youth, so-called millennials in the United States, and high percentages among others, to the point where even like one poll I saw had Republicans, 30% of Republicans polled had a favorable attitude towards the word socialism, which I could not figure that out at all, but that's the way it goes. So now there's another opportunity to get an open socialist, a member of Social Alternative, elected to a major city council, and this time in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I'm looking at an article here called Socialist Election Campaign Shakes Minneapolis Political Establishment. That's from October 13th from socialistalternative.org. The author is Andy Moxley. And I'm just going to read a quick thing from here. In the United States city of Minneapolis, Socialist Alternative member Ginger Jensen's city council campaign is shaking the political establishment to its core. Running on a strong socialist platform, Ginger is fighting for bold policies like rent control and taxes on big developers and millionaires to fund affordable housing and social programs. The campaign is a way to build a powerful grassroots movement of the 99% to push back against the corporate agenda in City Hall. Now, I've actually been to Minneapolis a few times, and the next sentence is, I think, very true. Against the background of a city that has one of the largest levels of economic and racial inequality in the nation, Ginger's bold campaign is receiving a strong echo from workers and young people. In early August, when the first financial reports were released for the election, it was shown that Ginger had raised over three times as much as her Democratic establishment-backed opponent. Not only that, but she has done it as the only candidate in either mayoral or city council elections, pledging not to take a dime in corporate cash. Truly a campaign that is not for sale. And what that means is that whenever anyone in Socialist Alternative, like Shama or other elections that haven't been successful or as successful, run for office, we pledge that the Socialist Alternative candidate will, if elected, only take the average wage of the working people they represent in their area. And by the way, I have never seen another candidate in the United States ever take up that offer, ever. And secondly, during the election campaign, not take any money from corporate donors, just no money from big business. And that is making a big difference in Minneapolis because it means that the supporters of the campaign have to really go out and really hustle for the $5, $10, $20, $25, $30 donations, whereas the so-called progressive opponent in the Democratic Party says openly he would accept corporate money, he will accept money from developers, and he wants to make life easy for developers. There's actually, I think, a quote in here about that. Steve Fletcher, Democratic establishment-backed opponent, much progressive rhetoric, but says he will, has said repeatedly, will take money from big developers. He stated in a September forum hosted by the Chamber of Commerce that he wishes to, quote, make life easier for the developers in Minneapolis. He further said he does not understand why developers, these are people that build, housing, usually luxury housing, were being singled out. This is like, this is the so-called progressive from the Democratic Party talking there. And yet, Minneapolis, if you include St. Paul right next door, they're home to, Minneapolis-St. Paul is home to 17 Fortune 500 companies making massive profits. The current mayor of Minneapolis, Betsy Hodges, was profiled, I think, in Time Magazine or some big magazine as one of three progressive newcomers. They had Shama Sawant there as well, and turned out to be a huge mistake to put Betsy Hodges in that category. She has just proposed a 2018 budget that contains regressive tax increases on the working class and poor homeowners, and despite progressive talk about supporting the successful fight for a $15 minimum wage, which I'll get into in a second, in Minneapolis. But despite talk of supporting that, the mayor's budget would only create one full-time position with the responsibility to enforce the new $15 minimum wage for 71,000 workers across the city. Given that American workers, I'm quoting again from the article, given that American workers lose $50 billion a year to wage theft, over three times as much as the value of all property crimes, the proposal is nothing but lip service to the needs of working people. Now, what I said about Minneapolis in 15, really quickly, is that basically, like in slightly different trajectory than in Seattle, there was already a $15 an hour minimum wage campaign happening in Minneapolis, led by 15 Now, which was initiated by Socialist Alternative, and other groups were getting involved, unions and people that supported higher minimum wage. And it was, they were, you know, protesting, like, for example, at the airport, because a lot of workers are clustered there that don't make any money, don't make minimum wage. I mean, just make minimum wage. They don't make a decent wage or a living wage. Don't make 15. By the way, 15 is not a living wage, but it's a good step in that direction and one that has caught on in recent years. And is now exists in many places, not enough places, but in certain cities and states around the U.S. So going back a couple of years, this campaign is going, and Ginger Jensen is the director of the $15 minimum wage campaign, and she's the candidate from Socialist Alternative running for city council now. And what happened was this became very popular. The campaign was working, right? And polling data in Minneapolis showed 63% for a $15 minimum wage, but the Democratic Party-controlled city council in Minneapolis would not move any legislation for a $15 minimum wage. So the campaign 15 Now switched to gathering signatures to get a question on the ballot for, it was going to be for actually the presidential election campaign this past November, presidential election day or whatever, campaign cycle or whatever you want to call it, this past November, that was going to be on the ballot in Minneapolis, $15. Still polling really high, confident of victory. And then at the last minute, the Democrats conspired with some Republican judges and together were able to keep the $15 minimum wage referendum from even appearing on the ballot. It just was declared illegal. And by some, trick, sleight of hand, legalistic sleight of hand. They said, oh, you can't do that. So gearing up to do it again another year, that collusion between the Democrats and Republicans, the way it was done, everything making people very angry, the Democrats decided to get ahead of the measure. And a few of them started to come out for it. And finally, they basically said they were going to introduce legislation to support a $15 minimum wage. And it passed. It had some real problems, given what compared to the referendum. But it did, through pressure from 15 Now and others from Socialist Alternative and other groups, the business people behind the Democrats were not able to get everything they wanted in it. For example, this will apply, $15 an hour will apply to tipped workers, which is a problem with other $15 minimum wage laws. Some of them have these opt-outs, they're called, for certain sections of workers that should be getting it. So in Minneapolis, they successfully opted out. Don't ask me how this makes any sense at all. The University of Minnesota, which is a big employer in Minneapolis and could easily afford $15 an hour for all its workers, they got exempted out. But at the same time, the corporations were trying to exempt out or opt out restaurant workers, anyone working for tips, and they failed, thank goodness. The pressure was too great. They couldn't get everything they wanted. So the $50 minimum wage law is helping people and will eventually help 71,000 people, but between opt-outs and phase-ins, which means delays, it isn't what it could have been, but it is very good. And Ginger Jensen should be getting credit for that. It's interesting. What I'm hearing from people involved with the campaign in Socialist Alternative is that despite the victory, because the Democrats ultimately put forward legislation on it, they're all saying, the ones that are running for office, all saying they supported it when they really didn't. They're getting credit for that. They either didn't support it because they didn't say they supported it, or they didn't do any work for it, or both, obviously. Anyway, one other thing I liked in this article was Ginger, quote, Ginger has already stood up. These interests have not faltered. As leader of the 15 Now campaign, Ginger helped an aggressive grassroots movement of workers, unions, and community groups to make Minneapolis the first Midwestern city to win a $15 minimum wage. She did this in spite of opposition of big business and the city establishment. Ginger is a true fighter for the interests of working people, and many of the most progressive labor and political groups have endorsed her, including the Communications Workers of America, Minnesota State Council, Minnesota Nurses Association, Our Revolution Twin Cities, and Democratic Socialists of America. Electing a second independent socialist to a city council in a major city after Shama Sawant's successful re-election campaign in Seattle would not only be a victory for working people in Minneapolis, but would be an important beacon across the country for working class politics. It would show that what Social Alternative has done in Seattle since 2013 is not an isolated incident, but the music of the future. Electing Ginger can embolden workers and young people across the country to join us in the project of continuing the political revolution and building a new party of the 99%. So, that's happening right now out there in Minneapolis. You could check it out by Googling Ginger Jensen, J-E-N-T-Z-E-N. Go to Vote Ginger, I think it's called, on Facebook. And that's something very exciting happening, and the election is November 7th. And if you know anybody in Minneapolis, try to turn them out of the campaign to find out more. Now, I'm sort of putting that forward as a contrast to what Sanders is doing, because a lot of people still have illusions in Sanders. What I think is important with Sanders is that, yeah, he is still attracting a lot of people around him when he does go public with a speech or something, and he is doing putting forward some issues that, you know, we would agree with, maybe not in the way he's putting them forward. Like, he put forward the single payer thing at a time when it was clear it wasn't going to pass, and he didn't build a movement for it. Like, right now there's enormous hatred against Trump and the things that Trump is doing, including the upcoming attempt to rewrite the taxes, the so-called tax code in the United States, to favor even more the super rich and the big corporations, lower the corporate tax, get rid of the estate tax. I mean, drastically lower the corporate tax, get rid of the estate tax, all that kind of stuff, which is just going to be a disaster for working class people. But you don't see someone like Sanders, who is still polling very high and putting forward things like single-payer health care, at least rhetorically. Why not call for a mass movement? Why not use your Senate seat, Sanders or whatever, to build a mass movement, you know? And the same can be said of the Democrats. If you have illusions in the Democrats, you would just look and say, well, why don't they go to the streets sort of with this protesting and with occupying and with really tactics that are not just trying the latest maneuver in the halls of Congress, which never works fully unless you have a very narrow view of what the word work means. No, but Sanders is not obviously out there building a mass movement. He may think he is by speaking here and there, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about putting infrastructure, money. You know, if Sanders could throw his ex-campaign staff or the Our Revolution staff into building a mass movement with other so-called progressive Democrats, if they had any real interest in that, which they don't. But I'm just saying that who objectively right now could be, what forces in U.S. society right this moment could lead a mass movement, and I stress the mass, against Trump. And, you know, there's also the AFL-CIO leaders could do that. They're not doing that. And there's, you know, reasons for that in terms of the lack of socialist methods and ideas and ideals in the labor movement right now, especially among the leadership, and the accommodations they are constantly making with big business, with the corporations trying to get on their good side as partners, quote unquote, like I mentioned earlier about Harvard, and instead just selling out working people. Like, someone asked me, like, I saw this thing on Facebook the other day about organizing Walmart. Now, Walmart, I think, has fallen away as the top so-called employer in the United States. I think that might be Amazon now or some other company, but Walmart's still big. It's always been a sore spot that Walmart is non-union, like a lot of other big corporations. So basically, what to do about that came up on Facebook. You know, a rhetorical question probably, but the person was like, hey, how do we organize Walmart on a union page I'm on Facebook? And I you know, said, you know, a few things that I'm not claiming are all original, maybe one or two of them are, whatever, but whatever. I'm not trying to be original. I'm just trying to get out good ideas and good methods. And so I said, well, look, first thing would be, in my opinion, you'd have to have a union drive that would cover at least a region, and not, you wouldn't go store by store. You know, you would lump all the stores together. You would hit every store with people working there, so-called SALTs or internal organizers. And you would not differentiate between each store. In other words, you wouldn't accept a contract just over one store. Not that it would, accepting a contract, that's, I'll get into that in a second. But anyway, you would be taking an approach that each store is part of this regional group of stores. They're not individual stores. People had trouble understanding that on this Facebook thing. They thought I was still saying go store by store. Well, you have to go store by store. This is organizing the workers, but you don't have to limit your goals to each store individually. You could. There's been pattern bargaining, they call it, in the labor movement since forever, where you would try to organize and sometimes successfully organize, even in the United States, an entire industry, or at least the entire company that controls most of an industry. And that a lot of those pattern bargaining agreements have fallen away as labor movement has gotten weaker, but they did exist and they are possible. And notice I said a region and not every last Walmart store in the country, because it would be very expensive for Walmart to pull out of, like, say, the Northeast due to a threat of unionization from their point of view, from the boss's point of view. So that would be step one. But so where do you get the resources for something as broad as that, an entire region, state, you know, five or six states, whatever? Well, you get it from the AFL-CIO. So you'd have to have the unions together saying to themselves, unionships, that even though we might not be part of this, American labor law is structured in a way to divide up unions. And unions should have never agreed to the Taft-Hartley Act, but they did. It took away things like solidarity strikes, otherwise known as sympathy strikes. The best power that labor has, except for occupation and strike, or strike and occupation, whatever. I'm going to keep throwing in occupation, I think that's important. But part of what was thrown away was, you know, like the idea that you could have multiple unions representing workers in one place. Now, you can do that and you can't do that. So it would have to be like different, according to labor law, different types of workers. So anyway, what you'd have to do is basically decide, have an agreement among the unions that you either forego that kind of old craft union way of looking at Walmart, like the truck drivers will be in one union and the workers inside will be another union, blah, blah, and you mush everything together and you bite the bullet and say this will be good for the labor movement as a whole, even if my union's not getting a part of it directly. Or, yeah, okay, divide up what you can. Truck drivers will be in the Teamsters, floor workers will be in UFCW or whatever, and then still have other unions involved that won't be part of that mess because they just see it as a positive for unionizing in general to organize so many low-paid workers into unions that, you know, exist in Walmart. Then, on top of that, have every union leader in the country of any size union or even smaller unions go on national television or call a press conference. The corporate media probably wouldn't cover, but call a press conference and very, very publicly tear up their paychecks and say, I'm only accepting the wage of a Walmart worker while this AFL-CIO union drive is going on to organize Walmart. And that would create, if once word got out about that, especially if it could get out over television, but even if it could just go out on social media, that would create such an amazing effect. See these rich, overly paid union leaders, except for one or two exceptions, the union leaders are way, way overpaid. And they would be pledging not to accept that pay.